Hi, everyone. You are here for the Taproom Brew Pub and Kitchen Safety Roundtable, I hope. Welcome. My name is Emma Vodder, and I am the Membership Assistant at the Brewers Association. I'm also the Speaker Coordinator for this event. I'm really pleased to welcome our panel for this talk. Our moderator today is Brewers Association Safety Ambassador, Matt Stinchfield, who's been in that role for 3 years. We're really lucky to have him. Matt has been engaged in environmental health and safety for 35 years. He's been focusing on brewery safety for the past 20 years, and we're so excited to have him lead off. Thank you, Matt.
Thanks, Emma. Okay, guys, we're going to have a little bit of fun today. It's conversational atmosphere. I'm going to start by introducing our esteemed panelists to you and sort of framing the conversation. So we're talking about everything today except safety in the brewery, okay? Because, you know, most often what we're doing is we're talking about brewery safety here at the CBC and in a lot of the materials that we're producing for members at the CBC, at the Brewers Association. But today we're going to talk about those parts of the business that aren't the brewery proper. So the kitchen, the front of house, bartenders, keg management people, and the customer experience. So all of those other things where other people are interacting with the brewery and brewery activities, and that's what we want to focus on. And we know from anecdotally from talking with lots of your colleagues that this is an area that has sort of been, you know, the stone unturned. And so that's what we're going to do today. I want to introduce our great panelists to you today. We have Serena Nuzil from Lady Face Ale Company in Agoura Hills, California. She runs a really super pub that is a brewery and a sort of French-Belgian bistro. High-end, super nice stuff, great views out the back window and all that. And so that's a sort of the single unit view that we've got today. We have Chris LaPierre here in the middle. He's from Iron Hill. And I can't say Pennsylvania or Delaware, or I don't know where he's from, really. But he's got multiple units that he's responsible for in four states on the Atlantic coast. And those are brew pubs with breweries in, you know, on the premise. So we have both restaurant and brewery times how many?
12.
Times 12. Okay. Thanks, Chris. And then here... we've got Paul Martinez from Brewery Pack in based out of Walnut Creek, California. I'm sure he's traveling all over the country. Paul is an expert in specialized insurance that relates to breweries and restaurants and some other specialized industries. So, you know, we'll have both the, you know, the, where the rubber meets the road sort of conversation today on how are things, you know, happening in the brewery, in the pub, and how... Paul, as a representative of an insurance company, sees those coming through. And maybe we'll get to the bottom of, you know, what's known and what's not known. That's our goal. And to talk about things frankly. You know, I'm not from OSHA, you're not from OSHA, they're not from OSHA. So let's have a frank conversation today and see what we can learn from each other. I've got about four topics that I want to talk about. We're going to go through these in order, and then we're going to have plenty of time for questions at the end. And, you know, while you've got these folks up here, now's a great time to just put it out there and ask those questions. So, again, the first thing here are safety issues that relate to brew pubs, but that are not the brewery itself. So not beer production safety so much as... how does that interact with the customer experience and the retail experience? The kitchen, the bar, and keg management, and customers. Then we're going to talk a little bit about what types of injuries we know are commonplace, and we should be working to reduce those types of injuries. Are we keeping records, and are we filing insurance claims if necessary or not? And then the staff safety concerns that have to do with how do we incorporate and inculturate new employees and existing employees into a way of thinking that is being proactive rather than reactive. And then the final point here, the customer experience access to hazardous areas, right? Do you have a pub where the customers can go flow freely into the production area? And if so, what kind of responsibilities should you have as a result of that? Lastly, sort of the mysterious thing, the one that's the most difficult to get our heads around, is the idea of safety culture. You know, what is it, and how do we build that? And is it contradictory to the idea of your brand culture? Is your brand really crazy and outrageous and risky and adventurous? And if so, are you sending a contradictory message to your staff about how they need to behave? Okay? And can you mesh the two of those? That's a big question. So, and then we'll come back at the end to questions and conversation. So that's all I've got for the slide deck. I've got a few questions here on my laptop, and I'm going to start with Serena and ask you, what do you think, Serena, are the most common injury types, the experiences that you've had in the kitchen and in the bar room? What kind of injuries are you seeing?
Well, I get the question a lot when people find out that I'm a restaurant owner, and they assume that I must be coming from a huge restaurant background and I know all the ins and outs. And they asked me what I did before I opened a restaurant, and I said I was a stay-at-home mom. So instead of being a mom of two now, I'm a mom of 42, referring to my entire staff. So I'm usually slapping Band-Aids on, patting people on the back, blotting tears, scraped knees, that kind of thing. But yeah, a lot of scrapes and cuts. But I think what's important is I try to treat a lot of that as first aid, because my first reaction is like, are you okay, right? It's like triage in an emergency room. What's the degree of injury? And then the next thing I think of is like, oh my God, how much is this going to cost me? So I try to treat everything as first aid, and I try to avoid a workers' comp claim whenever I can. Sure, you want to make sure your employees are safe and that they're going to heal properly, and you get them the right care. But it's kind of critical that you cut your costs, and I've found that just working with a local medical network is a great way to do that.
Super. Thanks so much, Serena. Chris, how about you? You've got units all over the place. What sort of injuries are you seeing?
The most common that we have, and we're pretty good about reporting them, are the thermal burns, so as opposed to chemical burns, lacerations, and then strains and sprains. And the most common areas for strains and sprains are shoulder, back, and knee. And we found the causes for them are mostly people rushing and not really paying attention to the task at hand. And something that we've really been focusing on a lot in the last probably a couple months or so is proper lifting technique. It's a big thing for us.
Right. What's a full half keg weigh?
Oh, wow. So that'd be 15 and a half times 8.5 plus 25.
And the answer is 165.
There you go.
That's right. About 165 pounds. And that comes down on the instep of your foot, and you can have broken metatarsals. It's quite a problem. So, yeah. Okay, good. So lacerations are pretty common.
Yeah, well, certainly having a full kitchen and a scratch kitchen. Nothing comes out of a bag, so it's
a lot of knife work. Yeah,
and
definitely. Is there some knife work training that's going on?
Definitely, and we've actually gotten people wearing chainmail hands, gloves for the non-cutting hand. We have lemon cutters, so our servers don't even have to use knives for the lemon. It'll, cut it into four slices all in one. And then certainly the training and making sure everything's sharp, probably a lot of people in this room already know that. But a lot of people don't realize that a dull knife is way, way more dangerous than a sharp knife is.
Right, right. And you mentioned that you're doing some reporting. What sort of internal injury reporting do you guys do at your company? Do you have a form or something?
Yeah, it's actually more than a form. It's a packet. So it's got a few different forms, probably one form for our insurance company, one form for HR. There might be a form for the state. And we have different packets that are state specific, because every state's a little bit different in their reporting. Mm-hmm. So every restaurant has got a state specific packet in it, and we try to report. You stub your toe, we're going to encourage you to fill out a report
internally, so you can at least track those incidents.
Exactly, because like a first degree burn on Monday could be a second degree burn a few days later from the same exact piece of equipment or the same activity. So if we can identify early on when and how people are hurting themselves, then it makes it a lot easier to prevent it in the future.
So in a single unit business, you might have somebody who's responsible for safety who's interacting with the managers, let's say, of each different area. How do you do it when you've got multi-state situation?
I'm not sure I totally understand, but let me know if my answer lets you know what you're asking. We have a safety committee that's company-wide, and we have one person that's in charge of the safety committee that works very closely with our HR and loss management department. And then every location has got one safety officer. And they're not full-time. You know, they're usually an administrative assistant, a server, expediter. And they'll all report to the safety manager. Mm-hmm. And they internally work with the department heads, the brewer, the head chef, and the general manager in the restaurant.
Okay, good. So let's say you have one unit in South Carolina. Is that right?
Just opened last night.
Okay, so you've got this one unit in South Carolina, and you've got several in Pennsylvania. Let's say the South Carolina folks are having a sort of recurring problem, right? Like there are a lot of back injuries. I'm just making this up. How do you transfer that institutional knowledge to the Pennsylvania guys?
That's a very good question because, like I said, we just opened this yesterday. And it's one of the things that's different about Iron Hill than a lot of chains is that we really focused on saturating one geographic area before we went outside of that. Mm-hmm. And one of the nice things about that is that everybody gets to see each other and talk to each other. So we're even outside of safety, that's one of the things that we're considering is how we're going to do the communication. So I suspect there's probably going to be a lot of Skyping in on like a physical face-to-face meeting. And then everybody has access to each other. About literally half of the management down there is existing Iron Hill employees, so they're already ingrained in the culture, and they're already comfortable talking with other people in the company. Mm-hmm. But we also just have a real open door policy where people are never afraid to pick up the phone and call people at any level.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. Serena, how do you learn from an experience that you have with one of your staff members? Maybe didn't do something the right way, got an injury. How do you make a learning experience out of that?
Sure. So most recently we had a rookie in the kitchen, or he thought he was better than he really was. And he had been told over and over again, slow down, don't do this. He was working with hot grease, and sure enough, went all over his arm. And so I took that opportunity to go through with the entire staff and do a whole retraining on not just working with hot grease, but saying, look, these are the circumstances that led up to it. And then explaining to them, you know, getting them to buy in and say, you know, look, this is not only my injury, but if I injure the company, it's going to put hardship on everybody because now, you know, I've got somebody else has to cover my shift, that kind of thing. So there's a lot of that. Did that answer the question?
Yeah, that's fantastic. Thank you. So, Paul, what we've heard so far is that lacerations, burns, you know, thermal burns, ergonomic problems with back or wrist or things like that are commonplace. What are you seeing on the insurance side? Which of these sorts of injuries are going as far as resulting in a workers' comp claim?
Well, quite frankly, every incident that happens to an employee should be at the very least reported to the insurance company so that if an issue arises 6 months, a year, 2 years down the road, they have original documentation and they don't have any grounds to deny the claim after the fact.
That's a great take home.
Yeah. So, and on the general liability side, every incident should be reported to the company. Absolutely. And for that same reason, because so many people, you know, that night might be okay and, you know, they say everything all right, everything's fine, no worries, then people get in their ear, you know, you can sue, you can do it, and 3 days later, there's a claim in. You know, sometimes it's longer, sometimes it's shorter, but the point is that every incident should be, at the very least, reported to your carrier. Whether or not it goes to full fruition, to a full claim, you know, that remains to be seen at that point.
What's yes, please.
We find a lot of times when, whether it's an employee or even more so the guest, they always
they always kind of want to be the hero and say, no, no, I'm fine, I'm fine. And you can tell they hurt themselves. Or they're like, oh, you know, we love you guys as a restaurant, so I would never sue you guys, so I'm not going to fill anything out. How do you counteract that, or how do you convince them that they should fill it out, even and that you're not going to, you know, take it the wrong way or hold it against them or whatever?
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, I guess it could be like a very important, you know, somebody who comes into your place all the time. You know them. You're, and you don't want to insult them. But at the same token, you know, I would use, you know, my insurance company is requiring me to make sure that everything is documented. You know, it's a condition of my insurance. Unfortunately, you know, insurance sucks. Yada yada yada. You know how that goes. But yeah, that's probably the and as far as, you know, your employees, you know, they definitely need, and again, you can put out OSHA standards, you know, you can a bunch of different ways that you can, I guess, convince them that, you know, this is just, we're just alerting the insurance company. If you don't make an issue of it, nothing will come of it. It's, you know, and just give them that kind of a comfort.
Thank you. And Chris, to follow up on that idea, do you find that some employees have a fear of retribution for relating that they were injured?
I definitely don't think so. Not in our culture. There's a lot of trust, in our company. So I don't think that's the issue. I think it's more of them wanting to prove that they trust us, I don't know, like, hey, no, I'm not trying to get anything out of this, or no, I'm fine. And like you said, it's more about them wanting to be the hero and to try to be an easy employee. I certainly don't think anybody's afraid of any sort of retribution.
Mm-hmm.
And we have actually gone as far as to, and I don't know if this is a law or just a policy, but our HR director has told us that we're not allowed to discipline an employee for breaking procedure if it includes an injury. So even if they've been told 3 times not to do what they're doing and they do it another time and they hurt themselves that time they're doing it, even though they could be written up for breaking procedure and doing something they were told not to, if there's an injury involved, there can't be any sort of discipline. And I think a policy like that and sticking to it kind of sends that message that, you know, you're never going to get in trouble for getting hurt.
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, you've already gotten hurt. That's your trouble.
Sure.
Right. So, okay, good. Well, Chris, let me take this to the next direction, which is what forms of education or training are you guys doing for your staff, say new staff and also for existing staff? And number one, what sort of training do you do in these front of house activities for safety? And number two is, and how do you document that?
We have it on a schedule. So Saba is the name of the software and the site that we have. So there are certain classes that are recurring every 6 months or every year, and a lot of them have nothing to do with safety. You know, it's like alcohol responsibility, sexual harassment, things like that. But among there are things like back safety and general safety, and that's something that's recurring. So if it's been a year since you've taken it, you have to take it again, and you have to take a test. Some of it is taught by our HR department. Some of it we bring people in. Our insurance company actually has a safety officer or safety specialist that will do some of the teaching. For instance, we just taught all of our head and lead brewers how to drive a box truck because someone ran over a fire extinguisher in a box truck. And we realized, you know, we got these kids that, you know, barely have ever driven a van before, and we're putting them in there. So they'll actually come out and teach the classes. And then a lot of it is just part of your regular training. One of the things that I do is being in a brew pub. If I have a new bartender or a new manager, the next time I blow down a bright tank and fill that bright tank up with CO2, I bring the manager or the new bartender in there. I open the door up and I'm like, smell that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And if you ever walk in here and you smell that, then get out, you know. So it's just something that we really, really focus on. But they're part of it is part of the general training for a brand new employee. And again, there's a recurring training, and the Saba software will flag it if somebody's out of code or expired or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned you have a safety manager, but at each facility, who has other jobs. How do you document that you had a safety chat with the staff, and where do those records live?
I believe they live in this Saba website and software, and they probably, when they take the test, would be the verification. So they have to take and pass the test. It's not a hard test, but they have to take and pass the test after the class, and that would be the verification, and that's where it would live. I'm sorry, what was the first part of the question?
Well, my question is, what do you do with evidence? How do you create evidence?
Right.
You know, for example, OSHA will tell you, if it wasn't written down, it didn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that goes for everybody of every size here. You know, if you have a 10-minute safety chat on a, you know, on the grease, the hot grease problem or whatever, you have to make a note of it somehow. And so I'm just asking you, where do those records end up?
Yeah, so they would be in Saba. Mm-hmm. And for new employees, they have to take a beer test, a menu test, and a general information test. And the general information test would include
some
safety questions as
mm-hmm.
well.
Thanks.
And then we have a twice-a-year safety inspection by that safety officer. And that's a piece of paper where it's documented. And that paper would be uploaded and kept in like Basecamp or Dropbox or one of the
sure,
storage.
Sure. So, Serena, thanks. So, Serena, in your smaller operation, singular operation, how do you document your efforts to train your staff?
Sure. Well, I am the safety weenie of the company, so I have a great part-time office manager, too, that's super at documenting everything. I mean, we even document stuff when we overhear staff like, oh, yeah, I pulled my back out snowboarding over the weekend. We write that stuff down, and it goes in their employee file. Everything is digital at this point. We don't print out our employee handbook, but I've got everything. I've got a giant employee handbook. I've got an emergency evacuation plan. I've got an illness and prevention plan. I've got all the safety precaution stuff, and I have a checklist, and it's part of their new hire packet. And all of those things are listed out, and I try to sit down personally with them as part of their introductory training portion and go through all of that stuff. Like, what do you do if somebody walks in and says, give me all your money? What do you do? Every time I leave and I go on a trip like CBC, I said, okay, if the building catches on fire, there's the door. You know, so just little practical things. You know, their eyes glaze over, I'm sure, when they get this e-packet at hire. But at least I've documented that all these things have been discussed with them, and they document by putting a signature on a paper saying, I have read it, I acknowledge it. Then if anything happens afterwards, you know, your butt's covered at least. But it's kind of the everyday stuff, like, hey, careful on that ladder kind of a thing. And just monitoring them. I mean, they're children, after all. You kind of got to pay attention to what's going on.
Thank you. Okay, so back to you, Serena. We're talking about now the customer experience. So the idea that people are coming to your business because it's really cool, they make the beer right there. Tell us, in your circumstance, what is the accessibility of any of the brewing activity or cellaring activity to your customer? Or is it like an iron wall?
It's actually very open. And I did, you know, kids and dogs, man, don't get me started. It's usually the parents of both of them that are to blame. But I caught a kid climbing on the side of the brew tank, of the Bright Tank, which is right out in the public eating area. And there's only a little chain that separates it. And I haven't seen that often, but I had to look over at the dad. I'm like, what are you doing? You're letting your kid climb on equipment. This is not a playground. But you have to do it in your most smiley, happy face, right? Because you don't want to piss them off at the same time. But I think it's important to have that confrontation. You know, when I see a little kid running around barefoot, or even adults running around barefoot in my brewery, I'm like, you know, I have an obligation here to keep you safe. And it's about having frank conversations with those people and saying, hey, knock it off. You're going to get hurt, and I want you to come back and have a beer with me on another day. So,
good. Thanks. Chris, and you, what's your circumstance in terms of accessibility?
All of our breweries are behind a glass wall, and we also have a company-wide procedure that the door's got to be closed at all times. A lot of the brewers, when it gets hot, they like to leave it open, or they're moving stuff in and out. They don't want to have to open it and close it, but we have a company policy that is closed. We also have a policy, though, that we'll give tours at any time. So it's really kind of up to the brewers to make sure that everything's safe. So we don't have a problem with saying, hey, I'm going to have to do this tour from the outside right now because they're, you know, CIPing a tank and there's chemicals flying around. And then it's the brewers also know that when they go home for the day that there are going to be managers giving those tours, so they know not to have, you know, a bucket of parts soaking in acid that a little kid can stick their hand in, or not to have hoses laying around that people can trip over.
Mm-hmm.
So we try to keep it tour ready when the brewer leaves.
Tour ready. Yeah good.
Exactly.
Good. Serena, what's your tour policy?
Not to have them, if I can help it. No,
not to have
just
them.
Just kidding. No, we do have a partition. I blew out a wall and put in a glass door so that if that's locked, people can at least look in and have that experience. But even when we do give tours, I tell parents, like, keep your kids close to you. You know, normally we wouldn't let flip-flops in here, and this is why. So it's addressing the safety stuff, too, as part of the tour.
So you're saying you do accommodate the clothing they're wearing. What activity do you restrict the activities they're able to participate in if they're wearing flip-flops?
Well, they wouldn't be in there if the brewers were in there actively working, mm-hmm. for sure.
Mm-hmm. Chris, do you have an age limit or a clothing requirement?
No, same thing. Just keep your kids close to you. And the two things that I always tell people is never assume anything is room temperature and never assume anything is water. So, you know, it could be hot or it could be chemical.
Mm-hmm.
So even though we try to keep those hazards at a minimum when they're in there, just, you know, you never want somebody leaning up against something they think is cold and it's your, you know, steam jacket or something mm-hmm. like that.
Okay, Paul, it's your chance to rain on this parade. If it were up to you, what would the customer interaction with the brewery facility be?
I would like it to be as minimal as possible, because of the fact that there are a lot of opportunities for injury. He actually almost described one to a T that I had last year. It was a tour of about 20 people, and it was one person keeping tabs on 20 people. One lady meandered off tour. She went to readjust something on her shoe, and she left almost a full skin handprint on a brew kettle. So
touching a very hot vessel. Yeah,
right.
Sure.
Correct. So, I mean, at the very least, I mean, and of course, I know one of the big allures of going to a brewery is to see the manufacturing facility, see how it works. So proper training, you know, even sending two people at a time, you know, somebody to take the front, somebody to take the back to make sure everybody is, you know, mm-hmm. walking where they're supposed to be walking and not wandering off the tour. There are some big pitfalls back there. And tripping over hoses is another common claim that you see.
Mm-hmm. So if you were, say, designing a brewery tour for a brewery, you worked at a brewery and it was your job to do the tour, would you build in a quick safety chat at the beginning of the tour for all tour attendees?
Absolutely.
Yeah. And what kind of things would you say?
I would even go so far as to give them hats, something that's so they can wear on their heads, safety goggles, explain to them. First and foremost, it's hard to say, oh, I'm going to keep all the hot tanks on one side. We won't get them near. But, I mean, that's unrealistic most times. Just explain to them what's going on. You know, it's boiling water. There's chemicals. There's fermenters, you know, bubbling, you know, all around you. You know, be aware and be as have as much common sense as you possibly can.
I'm thinking of Voltaire, the French philosopher, said, common sense, it's altogether uncommon.
You would be shocked at how true that statement is.
It's true, isn't it? So, thanks. Chris, tell me what you guys do on your tours as far as, do you make a safety message in part of the tour?
It really, really just the ones that I mentioned. Keep your kids close if they're in here. You know, really don't touch anything that's metal. And, and then really just kind of keeping an eye on them. But again, I think the most important thing is to not even have those people in the brewery if you're doing something where you're CIPing a tank or you're sanitizing a hose or heat exchanger with hot water. The people wouldn't even be in the brewery at that point.
Right. What I don't think either of you have packaging lines that you're regularly using, but let's say you had a canning line or a bottling line. Would that introduce further hazards?
Well, sure. If I had a packaging line going on at the time, there'd probably be ear protection and eye protection. They're going to be anywhere close to it, but we don't have packaging. If we do any packaging, it's a mobile canning line, and that's nothing a customer would get anywhere near.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks. Serena, how about you? When you do give these tours, do you let customers know what you expect of them?
I do, but I kind of roll it into more of an education type of thing. I talk about, I cite like the old Lucille Ball and how she was stomping on the grapes, and that was the technique for crushing grapes, and that we can't do that in the brewing industry, and because everything has to be super squeaky clean, and we use these chemicals. So I talk about chemicals, but in relationship to the process of brewing, so it kind of brings it full circle. And everybody knows safety isn't very sexy, but that's how I try to incorporate it and get them to listen a little bit.
Super. Okay, so now let's talk about probably the elephant in the room, which is brand culture versus safety culture. How does a brewery that's made its notoriety as being some sort of on the edge, maybe a little bit crazy, a little bit racy, a little bit dangerous, how do they, a bit counterculture, how do they incorporate a culture into their workforce that's going to be what a manufacturing facility would expect out of its staff in terms of safety, right? So that's a sort of a rigid, rigorous safety perspective. And then you might have a safety culture, a brand culture that's a little bit more out there. So Serena, let's start with you. How do you bridge the gap? Or is there a gap?
I think that I don't think the two have to mirror each other. I think that you can be fun and quirky and weird and edgy as a public-facing identity, but I think you still need to, bring that culture internally and be a little more serious about it. And I just don't see any other way around it. And I don't know how many of you have read Anthony Bourdain's Kitchen Confidentials. Anybody? Anything that will go wrong in a brew pub usually does go wrong. I had a 270-pound chef that one night decided Oxycontin and bourbon shots were a good idea on the line. And then the other
what,
one
what's
recently...
What's the problem?
Right?
Just kidding.
But he thought he was a cool, hot chef, right? Then I had a cook who was on antidepressants that found the really yummy pot cookies that were hiding in the back of the walk-in, and he ate the whole plate. And so that ended up, he ended up in the hospital because he had no idea he was eating pot cookies. And so that ended up in a workers' comp claim. So, you can have fun, but when it comes to these kinds of things, you gotta jump on it and take it pretty seriously because it'll put you out of business.
Right. Chris, follow on?
We try to really build safety into our culture. And you're right, it's not sexy. It's corny, But we just try to keep it as positive as possible. And we also try to be proactive rather than reactive. So one of the programs that we have is we have safety cards. And anybody can give anybody else a safety card. So if you see somebody standing on a step stool instead of a 5-gallon bucket to reach something, you'll hand them a safety card.
It's like a yellow card in soccer, right?
You're being penalized. In a positive way, yeah, exactly. Or if you see them, I'm trying to think of some of the safety practices. If you see them using that chainmail glove instead of, foregoing it, they get a safety card. And then this once a month there's a drawing with a safety card and somebody wins a prize. And it's during safety month, it's $100 in cash. Most months it's like a $50 Wawa gift card. So, again, just being proactive instead of reactive and making it positive instead of disciplinary.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then I have very strong feelings when you talk about the edgy, kind of like tough aspect of it. One of my biggest pet peeves, and I know we talked about not talking about the brewer, but I think you can take the same story and apply it to chefs or bartenders, but when people show off their brewing scars and when they're proud of their brewing scars, it's like, oh yeah, it's a caustic scar from when, you know, or when I leaned up against a pipe or something like that, and they're proud of it. It's like a tattoo. It's like, this shows that I'm a brewer. And I try to counter that with shame, frankly. I'm like, well, that means you screwed up that day, you know? It means that you made a mistake. And when you make a mistake when you're brewing, one of three things is going to happen, or maybe more, but you're going to cost your employer money, you're going to make bad beer, or somebody's going to get hurt, or you're going to destroy equipment, you know? And you won't find a brewer in the world that would be proud that they had to dump a batch of beer because they made a mistake. So why are you proud that you made a mistake when you leaned against that pipe or when you, you know, didn't have long sleeves on when you should have?
Like, sure.
You look at that as like a source of pride. I see that. I say, that's a day that you were a bad brewer. And you could probably do the same thing for chefs. You know, there are chefs out there that like to show off their burns or their cuts or
sure
whatever.
They do. Yeah. So to question to Paul then, Paul, what resources do you think, say, the company's insurer can bring to help grow the safety culture of a business, right? Because the insurance companies have some resources, don't they? And a lot of people don't, you know, utilize their insurer for that. They're just thinking, I'm paying the premiums, and if worse comes to worse, I've got some coverage, hopefully, if that's the kind of thing that was covered. But what else can an insurer do?
Well, insurers have what's called loss prevention departments, and it provides resources for the brewers. We can come on to the site and perform safety seminars, classes. You know, we can train them. We can train employees if we're, you know, writing the workers' compensation for the employer. There's a ton of resources online. Phone numbers that the employees can call, you know, if they're in certain situations. So it's pretty comprehensive what we can offer.
You'd encourage people to talk to their insurer and
oh, absolutely,
see what they've
and
got.
9 times out of 10, it's a benefit that's there that no one really takes advantage of because they don't know it's available. So yeah, I encourage everyone to call their insurance agent or their insurance company and say, hey, you know. Do you guys offer me any other ancillary services that are included? I mean, one of the services that we offer is when we do an inspection is thermal imaging. So we take a thermal image of the breaker box to look for hot spots, possible, you know, problem points.
Mm-hmm.
And we give that for, I mean, it's usually pretty pricey. You know, I mean, some breweries.
If you're going to just do that on your own dime.
Yeah, you're just going to do it on your own. And that way, at that point, you can enlist an electrician and say, look, you know, we've got some problems here. And that's a great way to be proactive. You know, God forbid one of those breakers should blow. You know, it can put down the entire system
mm-hmm,
at
mm-hmm.
that point.
Fantastic. So I think we've just scraped the surface on these different topics here. I'm going to give us a quick recap. And then we've got plenty of time here to start, you know, if you've got some questions germinating in your head here, that's why our panel's here. They're experts. They're like you. They've done the long, hard road, and we want you to ask them questions. So what we found out first off is that the commonplace injuries that are happening in kitchens and bars in front of house have to do with lacerations, slips, trips, and falls, ergonomic problems with back and arm safety, and perhaps there's a customer safety issue here as well. There's both a record-keeping process that takes place inside the business according to your own administrative processes, and then there's a record-keeping process that has to do with talking to your insurance company, and even if it doesn't result in a claim, you've got that landmark, you've got that line in the sand that says, you know, This happened. It may or may not be something, but we're letting you know on the front end. And then ultimately, if it's a very serious injury that goes beyond first aid, you've got an OSHA requirement and you may have a workers' comp claim. So understand what your particular needs are under your insurance and your state workers' comp program. We've talked about the importance of documenting any kind of training you're doing. It doesn't have to be sophisticated documentation. It could be a yellow pad of paper and a folder that says CYA, safety. You know, just put a notice in there. It's as important, it wasn't said here, but I will say that it's as important to document the people who weren't at the safety training as it is to document the people who were at the safety training. So, and number one, follow up with those people who weren't there and make sure they have the same conversation with you. And secondly, it's a CYA for the business side of your operation that, you know, we've been trying to conduct this training with this individual, we couldn't get it to happen, and, you know, and then this happened. In the customer experience way, we want to think about talking to our customers as they're going to encounter the brewery, whether it's on a tour or it's a very open format floor plan where they sort of wander through things. Certainly some signage is important, but, you know, after people have a few beers in them, they're not necessarily as attentive as they would have been otherwise. So keep that in mind. And then we talked a bit about the safety culture and how a safety culture, a professional view of safety in your business is not contradictory to an edgy brand culture, and be able to find the sweet spot between the two of those. So I want to thank our panelists, but we're not done yet because I'd like to ask you all if you have some questions for our group up here. And if you do, we have Mike over here and a mic over here. This is an audio recorded presentation, so I would ask you to stand up at the mic if you have a question and ask away, and we'll do our best to answer it. Yep, just grab a mic. Thank you. Yes, sir.
Hi there. I manage a production facility, and it's also associated with two brew pubs. One's on site, one's about an hour away. I've noticed, so as managing the production facility, I am the de facto safety officer. And so I have noticed that there is a difference in not only just the hazards that everybody faces in both the production facility and the kitchen and the front of house, but also a little bit of a difference in the culture and discipline just inherently in each one of those locations. Like the culture of a kitchen will be different than, you say, the servers and busters up front. I was curious if you've had to tailor your safety approach based on the section or the type of individual that will be working in that area, not just because of the hazards, but because of the culture that is inherently there.
That's a super question. Chris, what do you think?
Yeah, I can't really speak too much as far as the difference between the kitchen and the front of the house, but I think that definitely the brewery, and the brewery actually has a reputation for being one of the safest departments in the company. I don't necessarily agree with that, but I think a lot of it just has to do with the PPE, and people see that. So people see them wearing safety glasses and, you know, ear protection and oxygen monitors. And so I think they have that perception that we're very safe. I think you probably have to make a little bit more effort, I would say, with the front of the house, because I think a lot of them are not career employees, whereas in the kitchen you're more likely to have career employees. And this is a lot of speculation. And I think that safety training is probably more inherent in a kitchen than it is in the front of the house. So I think probably every chef that's worth their salt knows that dull knives are dangerous. But I doubt very many servers know that, you know, at least until they're taught. So you may need to put more effort, I would say, maybe into the front of the house.
Thank you.
Thank you. Serena, any comments on that?
I think cross-training is important. Like Chris said, you know, your host coming in, it's an entry-level position. In our restaurant, it's, you know, first thing I tell them is don't walk through the brewery. Nobody's allowed in the brewery. So then their only alternative to get to the employee restroom or the office or the parking lot, either they come through the front door and go all the way around the building, or they walk through the kitchen. So I talk to them about, you know, if you're going behind a cook, yell behind. If you see something that's slippery, somebody drops salad dressing on the floor and you're going around the corner, you know, have the busser point it out, you know, go clean that up. And there is that kind of, you know, back and forth that has to happen in both for all employees. So found that helpful.
Thank you.
Thanks, both of you. Yes, sir.
Yeah, thank you. From Baxter Brewing Company in Lewiston, Maine, we're currently in the process of building out a 5,000-square-foot brew pub upgrade from a 600-square-foot tap room. And as we go through creating employee manuals and trying to define what our culture is going to be, I have a question about safety culture, and that is, how do each of you deal with things like post-shift drinking, shift beers? Obviously, it's a tough subject. We're considering, we've been lax in the past about it and considering tightening it up significantly. A lot of grumbling from employees about that, but personally, I think it's the right decision. I'm curious how you guys handle that at your respective businesses.
Great, thanks. I know from discussions we've had online at the BA Forum that shift beers have a wide range brewery owners have a wide range on shift beers. So, Serena, let's start with you. What's your view on shift beers?
Well, first, I allow everybody to have one free shift beer. I think it's important for certainly server education to understand the flavor profiles, all of that. That being said, I limit it. When they go a clock out, they have to go present their clock out slip to the bartender before they get it to make sure they're off the clock. In California, it's now law that you have to have a responsible beverage server certificate, which is can be taught for free by the ABC or Sheriff's Department, but it hasn't been actually implemented as far as being a requirement. But about 2 years ago, I saw it coming down the line, and I said, I'm going to get all of my servers certified. You know, it's $8. It's 2 hours of their life. They just need to suck it up and do it. And in California, at least, and I'm sure Paul can speak to this, you can talk to it as well, it's on them. If they get cited for over-serving, it's a direct violation for them personally in addition to the brewery, the restaurant. So they have to understand the consequences personally and take it seriously. I have people that are, you know, going up to the bar and swapping out, like, I'm not drinking tonight. Here, you can have my second shift beer. So put a limit on it and certainly have a alcohol and drug policy in place. And if they violate it, you've got to act on it. You have to write them up. You have to say, look, you did it once, you know, shame on you. Do it again, you're fired.
And Chris, your policy on shifties?
I guess two different things. Whether it's a shift beer or not, we have a 3-drink maximum. So if it's your day off and you come in with your friends or you come in with your family for dinner, you can only have 3 drinks, and that's anybody from the owners on down. We stick to it. So you have your 3 beers, and if you want another beer, then you have to go somewhere else for it. I know a lot of breweries will have allow their beer to have their brewers to have a beer with lunch. We don't allow that. If it's during working hours, there's no drinking. There's just too many ways to hurt yourself in the brewery, and you don't need that added lack of attention. And then as far as buying somebody a shift beer, it's really up to the discretion of the manager. So if somebody did a good job that day, they'll buy them a shift beer. Our employees also all have a comp card, and it's loaded with money based on how the restaurant performs. So there's a little bit of a stick and a carrot there. One thing that I think is important is the pint cards that we'll sometimes give to an employee, you know, hey, thanks for coming in. You know, we called you in because somebody else called out or you ran a lot of food today. We'll give them a pint card. They can use that pint card for an appetizer or a soup or a dessert or something like that if they don't want to drink. So we don't want to give them a reward that can only be redeemed through drinking alcohol. They can use that for something else if they want to.
Sure. Great.
There was one other thing I thought of, and that, you know, I explained to them that they are always a representative of Ladyface. And if they're wearing a brewery T-shirt and they're not even in the building, if they're acting stupid in somebody else's bar, chances are I know the owner if it's local. And I don't want to hear about that stuff. You know, they do represent the company, and they need to behave themselves. The other thing is public perception. And I make them change out of their uniforms before they sit down and go have that drink. Because think about it, how it looks. You know, they just finished serving a table. That table doesn't know they clocked out and they're off the clock. And they're sitting there drinking. It just looks bad. So you have to explain it in those terms and always remind them that they are on a stage to a certain degree, and that they need to represent their company as they do themselves.
Thanks for sharing that policy. And turning your staff shirt inside out doesn't cut it.
Right.
I think we've got time for one more.
Actually, I just wanted to add a comment since we're in a safe place here. With the shift drinks, it's something we almost got in trouble for, so I think everybody could learn from that. If you have people there during odd hours, know what your state's laws are as far as consuming alcohol on your property, because it's different from state to state. And if you have, say, prep cooks that come in early and they're drinking, or you have, you know, some brewer that brews at night or any kind of shift work, it's just something to be cognizant of, because it's something we didn't really think about until it almost blew up in our face. So if you have odd-houred time people there, make sure you're really structured with what your shift beer policy is, and maybe that policy is different if it's an overnight shift or an early morning shift, depending.
But great, yeah. Great point. Your policy may not be consistent with state or local rules, so be sure you know what those are.
Correct.
For sure. Okay, great. Any last questions then? Listen, I'd like to thank our great panelists here. They were really helpful today. And there'll be, you know, of course, everything's online after the fact here, and I think there'll be audio recording for you. You know who these folks are. So here they are. You know, be sure to hit them up privately. I'm sure they'd be happy to answer questions for you after the fact.
Are our emails up there?
The emails are not up there.
I'd be happy to give my email address if anybody had any questions later. It's just chrisl@ironhillbrewery.com.
That's great. Serena?
Well, my name's a little complicated to spell, but it's Serena@ladyfaceale. It's simple.
And Paul?
My email is paulm@brewerypack.com.
Beautiful. Thanks again, guys, and thanks for your attendance today.
Don't forget Brewpub Open House starting soon.
All right.
Yeah, rock bottom.